Well, you know what's even faster to solve that problem? What we're building with chat, with CFO chat. Because I'm just listening to you explain like how finance teams are overwhelmed, folks just lobbing things over email to them. I need this report. I need this to be changed. I need that. And you know who doesn't care about stupid questions or repetitive things or minor changes to graphs? AI.
Hello, and welcome to Tech for Finance, where we help finance professionals leverage technology to level up their lives. I'm your host, Adam Shulton, and in this episode, we're going to be chatting with John Ladaga. John is the co-founder of Stirpy, a company focused on using proven templates to help build financial models fast without any prior experience or expertise in finance. Before venturing into the world of entrepreneurship, John spent 5 years as a digital strategy consultant at Accenture, working in various roles and accumulating a wealth of experience in the industry. Originally from Atlanta, Georgia, John attended Auburn University, where he obtained his Bachelor of Science in Marketing and Business Engineering Technology. That's right, isn't it? And he later moved to Denver, Colorado in 2018, where he eventually started Stirpy with his co-founder, Filippo, in 2021. The two of them met online through Indie Hackers and worked together remotely for the first 12 months of building the company before ever meeting in person. In his downtime, John loves to embrace the outdoor activities Colorado has to offer, from skiing in the winter to hiking and playing pickleball in the summer. So before we start, if you like what you hear today, please make sure to subscribe to Tech for Finance on your favorite podcast platform and on YouTube. But thanks for joining me today, John. It's great to have you on.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here. Thank you for the intro. I think you covered it well. Appreciate it.
We do our best, Dave. We've got to make it, you know, a good intro to keep people listening. Absolutely. Not that people don't listen, but you hear what I'm saying, right? So
absolutely.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been keeping up to date with Stirpy. I am pronouncing it right, aren't I, Stirpy?
You are, and maybe it would help for a little bit of context if I tell the story of the name, because we get asked quite a lot. Yeah. And I was just chatting with someone, and he's like, "You need to have this on the website somewhere." So my co-founder and our whole technical team actually is from Italy. And so it was actually my co-founder that came up with the name. And in Italy, they say to do things in a startup-y way. And so startup-y became a Stirpy. And so that's the reason behind the name, the kind of the story there. And we thought about changing it, but we said, you know what, let's stay true to our roots. There's nothing wrong with being a little bit unique. And I like the story behind it. So that's our name.
That's it. And it's reminded me of a book I read recently called Ideas That Stick. And this is a complete side note, right? You know, this is bonus content for our listeners, right? But Ideas That Stick is about copywriting. So I like LinkedIn. I like writing posts. I like doing the analytics. So I thought, right, well, what if I learned a little bit more about copywriting? And it just reminded me, because you spoke there about it being a little bit different. And in Ideas That Stick, the acronym that they use is SUCCESS, just without the S on the end. And it stands for simple, unexpected, credible. I can't remember what the other C is, but you get the gist, right? So, yeah. So you fall into the U of that category with the Ideas That Stick, which is basically an unexpected name. So yeah, I think it's memorable, and I think it will stick with people once they understand it. You know, maybe they stick with times, but then the brand is very recognizable. So it's all good. It's all good.
It wasn't a hard domain name to get, so that was nice as well. You know, that one was available.
Yeah, that's it. Years ago, I remember listening to all sorts of conversations saying it's sad when generating a new business idea is limited by the domain names that are available. it's the world that we live in.
I just saw somewhere someone was saying their domain register was the .ai domains. They're increasing the price of them. And I'm like, oh, yeah, it totally makes sense. There's probably been more .ai domain names registered in the past like 6 to 12 months than ever before, and whoever's running that registry is probably like, yeah, we need to up this price because these are hot right now.
Yeah, there must be, and again, I've not really done much work with web crawling and scraping, but there must be a way that you could do like a filtered search of domain names with an AI on you. And I know there's probably millions now, right? But I've been thinking about this recently because a database that I use to keep an eye on AI tools is a site called There's an AI for That. Mm-hmm. And I think it's mm-hmm. I think it's fairly recent, but it's growing all the time. And of course, they're compiling that information into different categories. You know, is it ChatGPT for spreadsheets and that sort of stuff? But there's no way of sort of filtering by industry or use apart from the tags, the use case at the moment, I guess. So I was thinking, you know, is there a way that you could literally just do an internet search for all of the AI tools that there are? And it's, I guess that may be a business idea in itself, right? But I always have to think about it. But yeah, that definitely with the AI domains, I agree. There's a lot more now than there was a few years ago. That's for sure.
Absolutely.
Very good. So the first bit is separate to what you guys are doing at Stampy. And I think it would be useful for listeners because, and I've actually been doing some training recently on managing remote teams.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when we look at employee retention, you know, and when we look at the way that we communicate effectively as managers and business owners, I think there is still a bit of a barrier when it comes to remote work. And of course, it's supported by the tools that we use. You know, you and I are speaking on Zoom now. I can hear you crystal clear. It's no problem at all. But having a conversation on Zoom is a little bit different to running a business on Zoom. So coming back to the fact that you didn't meet your business partner in person for 12 months, was that a struggle? And were there any takeaways from building a business for 12 months remotely that you think would be useful to not people that are necessarily building businesses, but people that are managing remote teams or working remotely?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think before COVID, it was an extremely bizarre, rare sort of thing for two people who had never met before to come together and start a business. Now I tell that story and folks say, oh, I know, you know, the founders at such and such company also met in the same way. And it's becoming a little bit more mainstream. And I think because of technologies like Zoom, Slack, et cetera, it's becoming more the norm. I do have some advice about, you know, for anyone out there that's thinking about starting a company and finding that co-founder. Maybe you're technical and you're looking for someone that's on the marketing and sales side or vice versa, and what that process should look like. So this is my second startup. And with this second startup, I was really diligent about the process of finding a co-founder. And so actually what I did and kind of how I met my co-founder today was on a forum called indiehackers.com. Really cool website for folks, mostly technical people that are trying to build kind of a side project or a side hustle with the dream of turning that into, you know, their full-time living. And so in that process, I was kind of ramping down my previous company. And so I wanted to be involved with more of a technical audience. And I wanted to kind of, for lack of a better term, kind of interview some folks. And so the way that I did that was I went on to Indie Hackers and I started saying, you know, hey, I'm a marketing and sales professional. I have experience with tech companies. Let me provide some feedback for free, completely pro bono. If you need some help in that area, let me help you there. And so I actually worked with about 10 different founders, just completely free, giving them feedback about their landing page, their website, their marketing, their copy, et cetera. And through that process, I got to work with a whole bunch of different folks. And I got to see the things that I liked, the things that I didn't like, and the ones that just came the most natural. And for me and Filippo, my co-founder, from day one, it was incredibly natural. I remember I sent him all this feedback around his landing page, and I get an email back like a day later, and he's like, great, done. Implemented. What's next? And I was like, oh shoot. All right, this guy's serious. And so actually, even before we officially made our partnership official, we had this kind of dating process of for a while we were just working together completely with no talks of equity, with no talks of roles. And it was pretty natural. And I think going through it that way, and then also explicitly, once we kind of got further down that process, talking about our own experiences with co-founders in the past. He came from another startup as well. He had a set of experiences. So we got aligned on kind of that process. And we were very transparent and open with each other in those early days. But so I guess just my advice to anybody that's trying to find a potential co-founder for a company is to, you know, just like dating, you know, take a couple shots, talk to some different folks, see what resonates, move slow. And you might be able to find your perfect partner there. As far as running remote companies, I think it's a lot easier at a small size. So from Denver, Colorado, where I live, to Ancona, Italy, where my co-founder and our developers are, is an 8-hour time change, which that 8-hour time change, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It stinks. But I'm an early person, so I'm up early. And actually, so we get an overlap from like 6 a.m. my time till about noon my time. So I get about 6 hours overlap with the team. And they start their morning completely uninterrupted from me. And then I end my day uninterrupted from them. So it actually sort of works out nicely having those pockets of time where we can come together and then those pockets of kind of deep work and solo focus.
Right. And yeah, that's definitely glass half full mentality, which is, you know, let's not think about the difficulties in working across different time zones. Let's think about the positives. And, you know, providing you've got your phone notifications turned off, of course, you know, because if you want to lie in, then you might not want somebody pinging you on Slack at, you know, 6 a.m. or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah, so. Using the like the focus mode on my iPhone during off hours is key. Otherwise, I start getting pings at 2 a.m. from Trello and from Slack and all that. So I'm definitely like a big user of the focus mode when I'm going to bed, for sure. Yeah. My co-founder does the same.
So focusing on Slack and Trello then.
Yep.
And again, this wasn't in any of the question topics that I'd sent across, but so I use Slack, but not for work. So mm-hmm. So Slack for me is community based. You know, so I'm part of a community called Grow CFO that's got a pretty good Slack network. And I've got a couple of, I guess, experts in the finance and AI community that I've got a Slack channel running with, but I'm not, you know, it's not managing a business. It's more sharing insights and becoming part of the conversation. So right. For work, I use Teams, Microsoft Teams. It achieves the same ends, right? You know, you've got different channels, you know, different teams, and you can work it that way. So I'm just curious about your setup. So you're still a small business, right? And so you've got developers, you know, you've got people that do different things. So, and it doesn't have to be detailed, but I'm curious to know how you structure your Slack. Is it siloed into sales, marketing, content? You know, is there a channel that only you and your founder have access to that you have a conversation with? And then is there a completely separate development channel? Do you have approvals built into Slack, you know, to say that when people are completing work, you have to have a look at it before it moves on to the next stage? So I'm just curious, and I'm thinking about my listeners, you know, that are either using something like Teams and Slack. A lot of people use it in a disorganized way, including myself. So I'm just curious to know what that setup looks like for you.
Yeah, I would say that we're more organized in Trello for kind of the approval process, things that are in the backlog. We kind of have a meeting to kind of review the backlog, say what we're going to put together in this week's sprint. So a lot of our organization is more so in Trello for kind of organizing work. But Slack, also, we do have some organization there. So we also have some contractors that we work with. So I have a specific channel specific to kind of one of the marketing and agency companies that I work with. So they're in one channel, and me and my co-founder have access to that channel. The rest of our team, they just don't need access to that. They would just get bogged down in it. So we do have it siloed into different channels. We kind of have a general channel. We have a kind of sales and marketing channel. And then we also do have some integrations that are helpful as well. So we have Intercom. We use Intercom for kind of all of our live chat support, help documentation. And we have a chat bot that will ping the Slack channel and say, hey, listen, someone's knocking on the front door. You need to answer them. So we do have some kind of automation built in there. But to be perfectly honest, Slack is more of the place where like the memes get shared, the AI trends get shared, and it's more of our kind of community forum and less about the staying super organized, where we do a lot of that in Trello. The other tool that I would say that I use a lot in kind of an asynchronous way with my team and also with customers for customer support, I'm obsessed with Loom. Do you know what Loom is?
Yeah,
it's been around for forever, but I love Loom because a video can, you know, a video is worth 10,000 words. And so often, whether it's a customer that wants to do something with our software and it's kind of confusing to say, oh, click here and then do this and then that, all with text, or I can just send a 10-second Loom video and record my screen, record my audio, and then I'm off to the running. Same goes for also sending design and kind of UI, UX feedback to the team as well. If I'm up late at night, the team's asleep, and I'm kind of tearing down a particular feature, or if I run into a bug, I'll oftentimes just record a Loom video and then throw that in Trello attached to kind of a card in the backlog. And it's just so much easier, especially there's also with my team, there is some level of language barrier. So my co-founder speaks beautiful, beautiful, beautiful English, but that's not the case for all of our Italian developers. And I speak a little bit of Italian. I'm trying to learn Italian more and more, but video, you know, is kind of synonymous, and I can kind of shoot over a Loom video of a particular bug, and it's a lot less up for interpretation than using text. So I use Loom a lot.
Yeah. But you get ChatGPT to translate for you now, can't you?
You can, but my team is in Italy and ChatGPT has been banned in the country of Italy. They are up in arms about that. One, like a couple of my developers that aren't as fluent in English, we try to do this thing where the developers are only allowed to speak to me in English and I'm only allowed to speak to them in Italian. Me and my co-founder, we speak English straight back and forth, but my team, they want to learn English. I want to learn Italian. And so we do this back and forth, and a lot of it's still, you know, just translating. My developers were using ChatGPT for that. And then the Italian government came in and banned ChatGPT. So now they're back to Google Translate. So, but yeah, pretty funny.
Yeah. It is a pain. And I, other podcast guest I had on, Angel Lan, she comes from a executive search, you know, sort of headhunting background.
Mm-hmm.
And, she was doing a bit of commentary on one of the posts I did today, and she emphasized that it's still not available in China and Hong Kong as well. So
yeah,
there are pockets that aren't able to use it. Yeah. Separate from whether that is the right or wrong thing to do for countries to ban, you know, large language models. Coming back to the point there that you said about of the Trello being more of the operational side of things, you know, mm-hmm. which is the, you know, I guess Kanban stage process, you know, information yep. against the card, and then that's moved where it needs to go. That's fixed. But I just want to touch on the point that you made about like GIFs and community and Slack, because coming back to the question that I asked that you answered very nicely at the beginning was, you know, how does that remote work piece play out? How do you make sure that people are still engaged? People are still, you know, having a good time, you know? And if people can't have a laugh and have a bit of a giggle, then, you know, what's the point? You know, so I'm a full advocate of having a, you know, a random Slack channel, you know, whereby people can just be a bit silly and share jokes and share the funny stuff, because it's, you know, it makes you more human, and it does really needed in the world that we live in right now. You know, human to human connection is a massive thing that you really struggle to achieve working with.
Oh, totally. Yeah, it's really important to us and kind of the culture that we're building to. You know, we have a small office in Italy, and lunchtime in Italy, it's interesting too, just like some of the working culture differences between the United States and Italy. But lunch is at the same time every day. The whole team takes lunch at the same time, which I feel like in the United States, we're less kind of structured with our lunch. It's like different teams will take lunch whenever, sometimes meetings get, but lunch is kind of a sacred time. 1 o'clock is lunch. And then after, usually the GameCube comes out and it's 30 minutes of playing Super Smash Brothers and whatever other video game is brought to your attention. But kind of having that, you know, and translating that to a remote culture is tough. You know, you don't have the same kind of, you know, luxuries of being in person. One thing that we definitely try to do, I try to make it over there kind of once a quarter to spend some time with the team in person. And I think as we scale, as we continue to grow this business, we will make an effort to kind of try to at least bring folks together once or twice a year from kind of wherever they might be in kind of the world to come together, have that team building time. So I think between having some contacts, like some actual physical contacts where folks are in the same room a couple times a year, that's important. But then also allowing to, you know, for the folks that are remote to kind of have those opportunities to share a little bit of their character, be a little bit goofy. And so like having a Slack channel for that, I think is great. And we always kind of, you know, start off our scrum calls and we shoot the shit a little bit and talk about, you know, whatever's going on in the world, funny things. The latest topic we were talking about was this new AI song for Drake in The Weeknd. Have you seen this kind of going viral on Twitter?
No.
Oh goodness. So
I will look at it. Yeah.
It's interesting now, right? Because music
is it deepfake?
Yes. Yeah. And it's like it's good. It's a banger. So like so someone took and, you know, cloned Drake, cloned his voice, and then cloned The Weeknd's voice, and then made a synthetic beat with AI, and then created a whole, you know, song with it and slapped it all together. And I think it has like, you know, 10 million views on TikTok and 250,000 views or streams on Spotify. And I think that the music industry is kind of freaking out a little bit. So we were kind of discussing that, and that was one of the discussions in our chat this morning.
It's how you police that sort of stuff is then.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It was. And unfortunately, I think, as we've seen historically, you know, when something gains enough momentum online, it's incredibly difficult to take it down, you know.
Especially music.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been a culture globally of not wanting to pay for music.
Yes.
So it'll be interesting to see kind of how this gets handled, because I think it's coming. I think within the next 6 months, we'll have like a number one global chart hit that's completely AI, whether it's ripped from some other artist or completely new. I wouldn't be surprised if that industry kind of starts to get disrupted a little bit more.
Yeah, and I think people will still have a preference. I mean, you probably see in the background, I've got a drum kit and some guitars on the wall, and people listening can't see. But as we mentioned before we started recording, my degree in music production and sound recording,
right,
my career did not end up there, you know. Part of it was the corporate ladder, you know, I was following the money, you know, mm-hmm. and if I hadn't needed the money, then maybe I would have done the musician thing. But yeah, all too familiar with the whole sort of, you know, musicians being paid nothing for a substantial yes. portion of their life before actually making any money at all. But I think people will still have a preference, because people will, to me, auto-generated stuff, I mean, taking ChatGPT when it writes content for you, right? There's something that's almost too polished about it. You know, with you literally having zero grammatical errors, you know, same with music, you know, people already get a bit fatigued by hyper commercial music, you
yes.
know, especially the heavy produced, you know, really loud, you know, thumping you in the chest. And, you know, it's great on occasion, but some people get really fatigued by that and they want more of the naturally produced stuff where there is the mistakes, you know, the mistakes kind of make up part of the authenticity of it.
Totally.
You know, and that's my concern with AI, is that we get to the point where, you know, that there just isn't any room for A, the ability to make mistakes, but B, that authenticity anymore. And it would be a shame
right.
to lose that. I think it is going to be a while, especially for the creative arts, you know, before put it this way, I think there's more scope for AI to replace certain operational roles, i.e. admin heavy tasks,
right,
you know, like what you were doing with your business at the moment, than there is replacing metal band, for example. You see what I'm saying?
I agree. Yeah. It's interesting. And I think you're right. I think those imperfections is what makes art and what makes music beautiful. And so it is kind of scary to think about a world where things are kind of run by AI and it removes that level of imperfection that makes things beautiful. So yeah, that is kind of a scary dystopian thought that I hope humanity can avoid and we can hang on to those things.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, let's not go too far down that rabbit hole today. Hey? So, but then coming back to the point about, you know, making sure that human element is built in and quite, you know, quite rightly, you know, you made the effort to go and actually spend face time with your team, which I wholeheartedly agree with. You know, we do a similar thing once a quarter as well. But for the remote stuff, and I'll just use an example with it, whether it's useful for listeners or not. But I mentioned that we use Teams. I did try a while back, and it's so subjective. It's difficult to actually do it. But I tried to write a cheat sheet for what form of communication would be best for what purpose. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if it's super urgent, needing an immediately response, pick up the phone.
Right.
Yeah. And if it's low urgency, but doesn't warrant an email, you know, is it an IM, you know, is it a Slack or is it a Teams, you know,
right.
If it's long form meant to inform, you know, is it an email, you know, so I kind of tried to apply some thought because the initial disruptor came when the likes of Teams and these, you know, Slack type applications came out because it kind of shifted from traditional email and phone calls into more of a collaborative way of working, which I think works really well. But the story I'll share is with a member of my team. So we were going through some analysis and I noticed something, and it doesn't matter what I noticed, but essentially it's something that shouldn't have happened. And I sent a short Teams message to that individual to say, essentially, look into this because it shouldn't have happened. And it was the wrong medium. Because immediately that instant message came across as cold and as hypercritical. Yeah. So I got, because they were tired, you know, it was coming towards right. The end of the week, you know, and I got a really short, snappy response. Essentially, you know, I'm doing as best as I can. And don't get me wrong, I'm by no means a dictator or a cracker of the whip or anything like that. You know, I do make a concerted effort to be, you know, a coach and, you know, all of that sort of stuff where I can. But in this instance, I've got it wrong.
Right.
As a learning exercise, that's got me then refocusing on, right, well, with the technology that we have available, what is the correct medium? You know, and more often than not, I'm now leaning more towards face-to-face calls like this, you know, rather than that instant message. But obviously that has to be balanced by how much time we've got, because some people like to talk more than others as well, right? So how are you going to cut people off after 15 minutes? But that aside... But the reason that I'm speaking about that again comes back to your point about using Loom.
Yeah.
Because I use Loom as well. And both are, you know, Tech Finance and work, just because it's super easy. But for listeners that don't know about Loom, just to expand on that a little bit, Loom is a means of recording yourself and your screen. You can use it to record just yourself if you want to, or you can use it just to record your screen. The choice is up to you. But the theory is, because they're automatically uploaded to the cloud, you don't have to produce them. You don't have to render them or do any of that post-production stuff. You literally end up with a video where you can copy a link and send it to somebody else in seconds. So it's the speed that's the real attractiveness of Loom. And the reason that I'm focusing on this is, you know, whether it's a finance team or an operations team or a sales team, coming back to your point there about what is the correct medium, you know, and a video says 1,000, 10,000 words in the space of 3 minutes, right? So really good use cases are for stuff like onboarding, you know, quickly producing the stuff that you repeated 100 times for every new starter that's come on board, you know, just put it on a shared Slack channel or put it on a shared Teams channel, you know, tech training, you know, if there is onboarding that's normally done one-to-one with internal systems, whether it's a finance system, you know, whether it's use of internal systems like Teams or Slack, again, you can do a loom. You do a three-part loom that just shows the bits that are business specific to you and then share them in the user guide for the rest. Do you see what I mean? And I think there's some really quick wins that people don't necessarily think about all the time that could be really good ways of speeding up process and just making sure that time is spent in the right areas.
Totally. Another one that is always good too is using Loom for customer support. And I think it goes back to what you were saying with kind of text-based communication. You can lose that tonality. It's hard to kind of it doesn't carry the same level of tone or kind of really how you're trying to convey that message. If I say, "Hey, I need this," is that I need this now? Is that I need this later? Like it doesn't come across in text, but with a video, it does. And I've found with customer support, if I'm just chatting someone on our live chat, it's easier for them to kind of dehumanize the chat with me, and folks can get a little bit snippy. And we've all been there, right? If you're chatting customer support, you're not happy in the first place. Ideally, you never have to chat customer support for any of the things you do. But when you do, we as humans, I think, have associated with such a negative experience that we're oftentimes snippy talking with customer support folks. And sometimes I'll just send back a Loom video and I'll say, "Hey, John Ladaga, co-founder of Stirpy, just wanted to show you quickly, how to do this one thing in the software." People's response to that is like, "Oh my God." They're like, "Holy cow, this is a real person. This is a human behind the screen. It's the co-founder talking to me." And I don't know, it's just a little bit of a hack, because I think one good customer experience can keep a customer for life in a lot of cases, and have a customer that will actually refer you additional customers. And I think Loom is a super easy tool for doing that. And we don't use it all the time, but sometimes I'll just hop in. I'll even do it with once a week. I'll kind of go through and look at new signups, and I'll pick 3, 4, or 5 new signups from the week, just completely randomly. I'll kind of search their email on LinkedIn and kind of figure out a little bit about what the company is, what they're doing, and I'll shoot them just a quick 30-second Loom video, "Welcome to Stirpy" email. And the responses I get from that are crazy. It's great for internal communication, but also for customer support and outreach like that too. I think it's just a great asynchronous tool for those things.
Yeah. And I think just expanding that a little bit to also be considerate of internal customers as well.
Yeah.
And I know, so slight distinction between what you were talking about with the team in Italy and what a finance team may talk about in terms of another department.
Yes.
And we've spoken about this a couple of times on the podcast. It's, you need to treat your peers as customers, not just from a service level and quality of the work that you do, but also from a gauging feedback point of view.
Totally.
And the thing that we get caught up on as finance teams quite a lot, and this is from the perspective of somebody who's not actually worked in a finance team, just works with a lot of finance teams, is that the challenge is that the number of things that just get lobbed over to finance, can you do this for me? Can you get that report for me? Can you do that? And immediately you end up with an email thread that's 20 threads long saying, can you just change it to do this? Or, I didn't mean that. Can you do this instead? So coming back to your point there, if we've got, a tech-savvy finance pro, and I like using, tech-savvy finance pros, this is my sweet spot in terms of audience, but tech-savvy finance pro. And if they're using tools that enable them to quickly share and relay information to their internal customers, so somebody comes to me as a, either somebody in FPA or financial controller, or something like that, and says, "I could really do it with some help with this." And then they do a screen recording of a couple of the reports that they've got. Maybe they've got some dashboards, maybe it's just an Excel pivot chart or something like that, and just walks them through it to say, "Well, here's a couple of things that might help with that, which of them is closely aligned." That way you're not making any assumptions. You're not having to make sure that you're emailing backwards and forwards. And instead you're able to say, "Look, here's a 30-second video. What do you want from me?" And I think immediately that removes the barrier of what we're talking there about just mindless chat messages and emails going backwards and forwards. And it's focusing more on the value and an actual proper response to something instead of just being a zombie sending reports here, there, and everywhere.
Well, you know what's even faster to solve that problem? What we're building with chat, with CFO chat. Because I'm just listening to you explain like how finance teams are overwhelmed, folks just lobbing things over email to them. I need this report. I need this to be changed. I need that. And you know who doesn't care about stupid questions or repetitive things or minor changes to graphs? AI. So it's interesting, like that. I think a lot of that back and forth, a lot of that problem that you're talking about, yes, video is great in a team scenario, but what's even kind of a step further is kind of what we're building with CFO chat. And maybe I can just explain just for context. I know you're aware, but maybe for your audience of what we're building with CFO chat. And I think it's just a good segue for into 100%. That.
Fill your boots. We have affiliations here, so nobody's going to tell us off for talking about a particular solution. So it's all good.
Yeah. But, although, I don't know, maybe Loom wants to be a sponsor of the pod after.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, so just to kind of bring it full circle here, you know, I'm a co-founder of this company, Serpy, and we build financial planning and analysis tools for founding teams. We have two tools. We have Serpy Planning. That's an early stage tool. It's all driver-based, all assumptions-based. It's not connected to any sort of live data sources. Really great tool. It's been used by thousands and thousands of founders in 98 countries to build simple forecasts. We have this new tool called Serpy Plus, and it's connected to live data sources. And so what we do is we connect all your live data, so from your GL, so whether that's Xero, QuickBooks, NetSuite, you name it. And then we also layer in operational data to build what we consider to be a full living model of the business. And then we've actually introduced GPT-4 into that in the form of what we're calling CFO chat. And so CFO chat is a always available 24/7, doesn't care about your dumb questions, AI that can answer, create charts, do analysis, and really cut back on a lot of what you were just discussing of kind of some of that tedious back and forth for internal finance teams or for founders that are trying to get a better understanding of their finance.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of interesting to hear you talking about that problem, because it's similar to kind of the problem we're trying to solve here.
Yeah, 100%. And it all comes back to that, you know, what's the stuff we don't want to do? Well, how do we get rid of the stuff we don't want to do so we can do the stuff that we do want to do? Now, in some instances, and it depends. So we've also talked about, you know, personal brands on the show before, where people internally might want to build their profile, especially if they work in a larger company, right? So there's a decision to be made, you know, do I want to take this on? Is it going to help me build influence and create impact? Yeah. So in which case, you know, maybe I organize a presentation, maybe I send the Loom, you know, maybe I make people very aware that I'm an expert and that I can solve their problems because I want to be known as the problem solver for my career.
Sure. Yep.
What you're talking about there is on the other side of that, which is that this isn't going to help me, you know, build influence, create an impact, or enhance my career. This is just a question that I'm asked, you know, two or three times a day, and I could do without going back to it all the time. Now, I'm going to give you a bit of a plug, because everybody knows I love this shit, right? So the video you put on LinkedIn, and I'll put it in the show notes so people can see. So as we said, it's called CFO Chat. And the example in the video was a SaaS business, you know, so probably using a bit of your data, I'm guessing, or, you know, you can't kind of like your data in the demo system there. So the question you asked was, find a month where subscribers grew the most. Yeah. And that wasn't revolutionary, right? Because it just came with a month by month breakdown of, you know, smaller number, bigger number. And you could get that information without having to ask, you know, a chatbot. That's not a particularly good use case. But then the next bit, and this is the mind-blowing bit, you know, not just with Serpy, but just with, you know, AI models connected to data, is you then ask, right, well, why do you think that's the best month? Why do you think it grew that much in the months? And the AI came back saying, and it was like four or five parts to the response. But the one that jumped out to me was one of the last points that said, it appears that there was an increase in paid search traffic. Yeah. So, and it comes back to your point there about being tied up to operational stuff, because if you were just latching onto finance data, UGL data, you know, unless it was live data whereby you had a GL code or a reporting metrics that said, you know, paid advertising spend, you know, and all of that sort of stuff. But what it very much seems to me, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that because it referenced paid search traffic, that it was connected to something like a Google Analytics or another platform that was feeding it that information as well. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. So the kind of secret sauce behind what we're building with Stirpy Plus and CFO Chat is this concept of building a live financial model. Mm-hmm. And when you think about the data, you know, if you think about, you know, how do we build kind of a digital clone or a digital twin of our business, the GL is just going to have kind of part of the data. It's just going to have kind of, and to be honest, the GL is just going to have what happened in the past. It already happened, right? It's not forward facing, but it's also missing a lot of the context for why sales increased, for why expenses went up, for why, you know, X, Y, Z. And so what we do is we build this concept of a live financial model or a living model, and we layer in operational data. So you can connect. And in that use case, it was connected to, I think, Xero for the GL, Google Analytics, and then some Stripe data as well. It was all pulled in to that. And when you feed that level of context, now the AI is able to say, okay, you know, based on this result in the GL, why could that have occurred? Well, let's go look at our traffic sources. Let's go look at what our conversion rates were. Let's go look at all of these things to try to get to that level two, that understanding behind just surfacing that KPI. And that's really where we think this technology gets really interesting, because if you're just surfacing KPIs, if you're just saying, you know, what was my revenue last month? It's cool, but like a dashboard or even just kind of like, you know, a P&L from your GL software is going to provide that. But doing that analysis, or at least guiding a financial analyst or a founder towards the areas that they should probably take a double click on, is what we're really excited about. And I think that's really only possible from having this concept of a living model of your business, where all that data is in real time and it's all aggregated and pulled together.
I often pause to let these things sink in, because not because I'm struggling for stuff to say, right? Even though sometimes I do struggle for stuff to say, but it's, as soon as I look at this sort of stuff, my brain just goes into, okay, and then next, and then next, and then next, and then it starts sort of bringing in all of these. And what if you connected that, you know, and what if you connected that? Because you're getting to the point where you've got a complete ecosystem where you could do everything with a chat interface, right? Literally ask chat anything. And again, a slight side note as well. The co-founder of HubSpot has just bought the domain chat.com for 8 figures, I think.
Yes. Yeah, I saw that. Darmesh. Yeah. Insane.
So, yeah, that's it. I think
he bought prompt.com for like 7 figures too. But, this is what you get to do when you're a billionaire, you know?
Yeah, you were, yeah, that's it. And that podcast was actually my first million. So they, yep. they and we spoke about that on LinkedIn chat, didn't we? And so the reason that I mentioned that is because, you know, there are some seriously smart people with a lot of money that are putting their cards, you know, that basically putting their eggs in this chat basket, you know? Yep. I have spoken to some guests that don't necessarily believe that chat is the be all and end all. I think it's easy. Yeah. I don't think we should limit ourselves to just an IM based chat. And it would be interesting to see about how that evolves. And I know with GPT-4, especially with the new API, it's not just text, it's image, audio. Maybe you can tell me personally, I haven't been granted access to the GPT-4 API yet. So I haven't been able to use any of the image recognition or any of that sort of stuff. I don't know whether you've had opportunity to play around with that. But where I'm going with this is, if it gets to the point where we've got lots of live data points feeding into a chat interface. You know, use your example, you know, Stirpy Plus with your CFO chat.
Right.
We are then into proper replacing people territory, you know, but or maybe not replacing, but seriously reducing the need to hire new people, right? You know, so it means that if you are a smaller business and you're thinking about, right, well, do I need to build a finance team or do I need to build this? You might think twice before you invest in people because you've got technology that can aggregate a lot of the data for you. So I think especially traditional roles whereby a more traditional CFO who just expects to be the font of all knowledge whereby everybody comes to them for answers to the question, it's not going to be the case anymore because people are going to be able to self-serve a little bit more. So I don't know what your impression is of the way that people need to start thinking, but if I was in that position, as I kind of am, because I don't think anybody's job is completely safeguarded against the evolution of AI, but for me, I'm just thinking about what skills people need to invest in and what people need to be focusing on if they are not the resource for this information anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because the technology is evolving, right? It's like there's kind of like at the surface level, there's a technology like ours can be used to surface KPIs. And it's like, okay, that's great. You can, you know, surface KPIs, see, you know, chat with your data in the past and kind of see what your revenues were last month or whatnot. That's kind of level one. And then there's kind of this level two of, you know, the example that you shared of why do you think we grew this month? And then a bot being able to kind of say, okay, well, here's some feasible reasons as to why. And then there's kind of a next level of proactively monitoring and reporting. So kind of where we're taking this too is we have the live data built in a living model. And it would be extremely cool if you could just say, all right, CFO, just monitor my company and you surface the insights. You tell me the high level surface data because I don't have all day to be looking at, you know, I don't want to be looking at my financials all day, nor do we have a full-time hire to be doing this. And so will that then replace the need for, say, a financial analyst or a fractional CFO for a small business? It very well could. And so I was having a conversation with for an interview with Morning Brew that just got released about this exact topic of, is AI going to displace knowledge workers? And it's interesting because I think that if this technology continues to grow at the exponential pace that it's growing, the world could look so different just in 12, 24, 36 months. And, you know, it's just really interesting. And I think that it's something that as knowledge workers, whether you're in legal or you're in finance, you should be thinking about how you can position yourself to kind of leverage these tools and not be replaced by them in ways. I still think we're a ways away from kind of fully replacing the role of a CFO, right? Like, I don't think that the AI is going to, you know, I think for the same reason that we were talking about where with team building, it's still important to be goofy and be human. We still value those things. And so I don't think if I'm a company and I'm pitching a set of investors, they want to sit down with our chatbot and just ask the chatbot questions. Maybe they do. I don't know. But my thought is that you still want that, you know, you'd rather have a human CFO that's sitting in the room with these investors saying, hey, you know, let's discuss this over lunch versus a chatbot that's yeah. Kind of cold. But it's interesting.
And it is that perception as well, isn't it? Because, and it's also experience. So I focused on one example there in your demo of one of the points coming back being, you know, it was potentially increasing paid, whatever it happens to be. But let's not forget the fact that it actually gave us quite a lot of reasons. Yes. So that there is still a person that will need to have a look at the thing. Do I agree with those results? You know, and what I often do is I will now always ask ChatGPT to give me a certain number of results when I'm asking it anything. So if I'm asking it to model a certain scenario or, you know, give me some inspiration for stuff, it's, you know, I need at least 3 to 5, because then I can look and see whether I think that that's accurate, what it's being produced. Because again, accuracy is still a thing. I mean, it's going to be more accurate if it is working on your data, assuming that your data is accurate. But then that at least gives you the ability to pick and choose, to say, me as a human with experience, I'm going to choose this outcome, you know, weigh it against the data that I've got myself that isn't bot generated, and then come to a conclusion. And it's very similar topic that I had in with Chris Riley in the last podcast, whereby we gave the example of stuff like weather and farmers that have been farming land for 20 years, you know, 20 years worth of intrinsic human-based gut feeling and experience can't yet be put into a language model.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're exactly right. Like with our example of CFO chat coming back and saying these, you know, here's 5 potential reasons, it still takes a human to say, oh, you know, let's look at all those 5. Let's see the ones that are worth double clicking on, and then being able to do their own analysis. And then maybe, you know, if you do your own analysis and you see, okay, subscribers were up quite a bit from paid traffic sources, it's still going to take someone analyzing that to then tell maybe the CEO or the head of marketing that, hey, we think there's a reason here to continue doubling down. So there's a handful of steps to take that insight and actually act on it. And I think that humans, you know, if we can kind of help brainstorm those potential insights and then let humans do the double click and then communicate that into kind of a business strategy, I think that's going to be the role that kind of AI plays, specifically in the finance world, in kind of the short term. But it's very similar to what you're saying with using, just if you're using ChatGPT to research blog article ideas or for any of these tasks, where it'll give you, you know, 5 or 10 kind of potential topics for a blog article, but then you still have to be the one to say, okay, yeah, that one I think will resonate based on my gut feeling and my understanding of my audience. And I think that level of comprehension is just going to be, that nuance is going to be something that a human is going to be able to do better than an AI for at least, you know, who knows? I might eat my words in 12 months, but at least for the foreseeable future, there are some interesting things. I know this is, you know, the audience on this podcast likes technical stuff. There's some interesting stuff going on with AI with reflection, with self-reflection. I don't know if you dug into that at all. Do you know the topic about reflection?
I've deliberately put off it a little bit. I've kept loosely up to date with the experiments that I think Stanford did when it did like a sim scenario where multiple bots were placed in a started communicating with each other. In terms of self-reflection, no, I'm not.
Yeah, so there was a paper that came out, and I'll send it to you later if we want to throw it in the show notes or something. But academic paper that came out that said they tested, I think it was GTP4 against GTP4 that self-reflects. And basically you might have experienced this yourself just with playing with ChatGPT. Sometimes ChatGPT comes back with an answer, and then you say, you know, and you notice that there's something kind of hokey about the answer that it gave you, and you say, you know, think about that answer. Was that answer correct? And then remarkably, it will reflect on that answer and then fix its mistakes. And they found through this academic study that the level of accuracy is, you know, extreme improvement with self-reflection versus kind of the first attempt at answering a question. And so I think from an accuracy perspective, it'll be interesting to see how that starts to get implemented as well in the world of AI, of kind of these AIs, before they actually spit out what they're thinking to you, having them internally self-reflect on that answer, say, is that correct? And then giving you that feedback, because it seems like the performance is extreme. There's an extreme improvement there with the concept of reflection. So yeah, it's just interesting how fast this stuff's moving.
It'll be interesting to see whether you actually get the full trail of the reflection as well. Because my thought says that you probably won't see it. So that reflection probably be built before it actually gives the answer, because the end result is something that's more accurate, right? But we'll have to see what we've done. And yeah, just to back that up, I mean, yeah, obviously the move from GPT-3 to GPT-4 was a big one.
Yeah.
And in terms of accuracy, and yeah, it's a bit slower, but, you know, it's passing a lot more tests. But it still isn't great when it comes to 100% accuracy. And sometimes, you know, I cheat a little bit. So a LinkedIn post is 3,000 characters. And I'm just using this as an example. And sometimes if I write something naturally, I get to the point where I'm doing, you know, 3,500, maybe even 4,000, which is, it takes a long time to think about how to cut, because you don't really want to cut any of it out. That's the big problem that we've got as people, is, you know, which we like what we write, you know, oh, this is all good stuff. You know, I don't want to have to shave any of it, but giving it to an AI that doesn't care, you know, it's just like, yeah, I'll do it. So if you say, you know, cut this into 3,000 characters without losing any of the meaning, and that's the important bit, you've got the structure, and it will come back and it'll rejig it. But I can't remember. I was writing to a certain length. It wasn't LinkedIn. It was something, and it was in excess of 10,000 characters or something like that. And I think the limit was 10,000 characters. And again, I forget the specific example, but I actually had to tell it twice. So it produced me a bit of content, you know, and I gave the limit of saying, you know, it's 10,000 characters or whatever the limit was.
Right.
And it produced the result. And it wasn't 10,000 characters, because I dropped it into a, God, this, it must be a really boring conversation to be coming in at this point, right? Anyway, so I dropped it into just a character counter online, and it came up with 14,300, whatever it is. So I went back to ChatGPT and I said, are you sure that this is the correct characters? And it came back and it said, yes, I can confirm.
So
I then asked it again, are you sure you're sure? And only then did it come back saying, apologies for the mistake, it's actually 4,600 and whatever. And I don't know whether it was just, you know, a ghost in the machine that it fought back twice. But yeah, it was, it kind of does make you question, again, coming back to the accuracy piece. So if you don't do that validation and you train yourself based on the fact of just asking again, because 9 times out of 10, you know, that if you ask ChatGPT again, it's going to correct yourself.
Right.
I wonder how many times you'll miss the second inaccuracy. Do you see what I mean? So it's, again, the mind boggles, and, you know, it's still all in development, mega quick, but, you know, it's developing at the pace that they are whilst ensuring accuracy is maintained. I don't think it's an easy job.
No, I would agree with you. I think there has been a huge step from GPT-3 to 4. In kind of what's called like the adherence to system prompts, right? So when you're creating an agent, so, and this might just be helpful to folks in understanding these things, there's fundamentally a big difference between ChatGPT and GPT, right? So if you're a business wanting to leverage this AI, wanting to use OpenAI's large language model, you're using GPT. You're not using ChatGPT. It's not going to interact the exact same way, because ChatGPT has been trained in a special way to be a Q&A bot. It's been trained in for the specific use case. When you start using the underlying technology, GPT, you the kind of programmer, you the business operator, you are creating the system prompt, which is basically the system message of saying, here's what you are, ChatGPT, or GPT rather. Here's what you are. Stay in your lane. You're a fractional CFO, and you respond in this way, and all of these things. And GPT-4 has gotten so much better at that adherence than 3. So it's getting better on the first try, but I still think you're exactly right with like the reflection piece of asking things the second time. It improves, but you got to just think that if they're moving at this pace, some of that is going to be fine-tuned, you know, in subsequent releases in the future as well.
Yeah, well, if there are releases, because again, a lot of heavyweights saying, oh, pause, you know, we can't keep up. And that is completely unfounded. I mean, it did make me smile, because one side of me did think, you know, this is a competitive thing, right? You know, yes. we need to stop the momentum because they are now so far ahead, you know. And the best quote I saw online was like, I'm a billionaire and I can't keep up. Please stop for 6 months. It was one of those. And again, that's completely unfounded because I actually have no knowledge, because as much as I love talking about AI and I use it as part of my work, I can't credibly be able to say whether it's a good idea to pause or not, you know. So but that's probably a conversation for another day, right? But it's interesting that point that you made about the distinction between GPT and ChatGPT, because
yes,
I think this is where a lot of the process is either, it's kind of the make or break moment, isn't it? And you and I, again, before we started the show, we talked about companies like yours that haven't approached things in the same way as you have, in the right way, basically just trying to produce stuff as quickly as possible without checking whether it's decent or not, you know, basically could be built on a really rubbish idea that they're putting out into the world. So putting something quickly out in the world, if it's rubbish, doesn't necessarily mean that you can make any money from it, and so on and so forth. But I think it's interesting, and it would be the same as normally, right? You know, some companies that do have large IT resources might be able to use GPT internally without needing to procure an external software system, right? I don't think that's going to change. It's the same as, you know, if you did in-house development of a legacy system as opposed to upgrading to it. You see what I mean? It's exactly.
Yeah, you can build your own CRM system, right? Yeah. I mean, you could. You don't need a HubSpot.
Yeah, absolutely. I've implemented HubSpot, but God, I wouldn't build it. No, definitely. But it comes down to that, you know, the biggest gap with a large language model is it doesn't understand the context unless it's trained on the context. Yeah. You know, so to your point there, it is just an algorithm before you say to it, you know, act in this way, act as a fractional CFO, you know, you are a fractional CFO.
Right.
And I think it's going to be interesting because this is where all of the various offshoots, you know, and like you guys that are doing it very well and some of the others, it's how good they are at controlling that algorithm and giving it that context. And I think that's the biggest limitation companies trying to do it in-house will have, at least initially, is because they haven't been at the bleeding edge of, you know, building these algorithms into platforms that they're not really going to know what the starting point is. You know, what does make a good instruction on how to control and guide this large language?
Yes.
I think it's going to be a real learning curve.
Yeah, I think one last thing too, it's interesting too, because in the world of finance specifically, your data is, it's ever changing. It's evolving every single day. There's new transactions, there's cancellations, there's new signups. And so to build a system that can take all of that context in and continually evolve as well to that ever changing context, that's where we focus. And that's where we kind of differentiate than a lot of some of the other kind of proof of concepts you've seen out there potentially, where it's kind of like upload a 10K from Tesla and be able to talk to that document with AI. That's great. But business finance, the data is so granular and changes and evolves. So how do you continually synthesize all that data and then feed it to an AI that can kind of evolve with it as the context changes? It's updating forecasts, it's changing things around. And so that's where we're kind of focused with our technology. And that's, that piece is quite a lot harder to do than to say, you know, create a chat bot with our support documents that are static, you know, and you can kind of do it one time or upload a 10K and be able to talk to it. So having that live system, that's, you know, at the end of the day, data is critically important. Yeah. And so having that good data pipeline, those live data's as kind of the basis for what the model is trained on is hyper important. One other thing just worth mentioning on kind of the difference between GPT and ChatGPT is that unless you specifically opt out, if you're a ChatGPT user, the data, the prompts that you're entering in is being fed back to OpenAI to potentially retrain future iterations of the model for GPT 4.2 and 4.4 or whatever comes next. Whatever you're feeding it could potentially be used. There's a form that you can actually basically send in that says, hey, I don't want my data to be given back to OpenAI. But if you're a finance professional, just be very careful about what financial data from your company that might be sensitive that you're feeding to a ChatGPT, because that might be going to OpenAI, and we just don't want that. You know, when you're using a software like ours, where we're using GPT, that data for us, it lives in Microsoft in a secure data warehouse. It never gets fed back to OpenAI. It never goes anywhere else. It stays within a container. So I think another thing that's just important as companies start to try to, you know, leverage these technologies is how do we do it in a secure cyber way as well. From kind of a data security reason.
Yeah, totally agree. You know, and we touched on obviously, you know, Italy and China highlighting it as a cause of concern, you know, mainly around data. But Christian Martinez, who's been on the podcast before, finance automation at Kraft Heinz, really smart. He's given presentations. He absolutely loves ChatGPT. One of his posts, and I'll put it in the show notes as well, relates specifically to ChatGPT security. One of the ways, and it's what I do, you know, I basically give it hypothetical scenarios instead of actual scenarios.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't give away company names, you know, and all that sort of stuff. It's act as if you were, you know, working for a company of this type, producing this sort of stuff. Because in that way, there's no way to attribute data to a name.
Right.
But the third bit, and this comes back to your point, and again, I think it's only really businesses that have got a certain level of IT expertise in-house that could do this, but it goes back to what you say there, you know, don't use the chat interface, you know, use it raw with Microsoft Azure, you know, but again, you've got to set that up somehow, which isn't the easiest thing to do. I mean, he made it seem easy, but he's very good at making things seem easy, right? So yeah. So I have two more questions if you've got 5 minutes.
Yep, absolutely.
Yep. So the one relates to AutoGPT.
Yes.
Have you used it yet?
I haven't. Well, yeah, I've used it in the browser. I've never done anything with development, but I used Agent GPT, which is like a early browser version of it. Yeah.
So I've been playing around with that. The only reason I ask the question is because at the moment, I don't have access to the GPT-4 API. So at the moment with AutoGPT, I can only use 3.5s.
Yeah.
You know, but my initial impression is that it's still tripping over itself quite a lot. And for people that are listening that don't know, AutoGPT or Agent GPT compared to normal ChatGPT are more autonomous. So we're moving into autonomous AI, whereby instead of giving it specific prompts and it's a Q&A, you give it an end goal and it will self-prompt.
Right.
So the example that I gave today was create a financial presentation based on being the CFO of a hospitality industry wanting to do a benchmark report or something like that, you know, find industry KPIs, find industry benchmarks, and then create me some presentation slides. So you'd be able to do that in ChatGPT. You wouldn't be able to do the internet piece because, of course, it's not connected to the internet. Yeah. I mean, there's ways of connecting it to the internet, right? But the point there is one prompt could potentially facilitate quite a lot of rounds of Q&A. And it did it pretty well, you know, so went to the internet and it found the KPIs that were hospitality specific. So that was great, you know, and it came back with some percentage benchmarks, even though you'd have to double check them again down to the accuracy piece. And it did a reasonably good job of producing the presentation slides, or at least the high level stuff, but it wasn't as accurate as GPT-4. Hence why I'm really keen to try it with the GPT-4 API, though the GPT-4 API, as you probably know, is more expensive to run than 3.5, you know, so.
Significantly so.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, don't just let it run continuously, because otherwise you might end up. And I think, you know, with what I've only spent like 10p, you know, with ChatGPT 3.5, you know, in playing around with it this week. But it's just for people to be aware, you do need an OpenAI paid for API, and you can quickly start running up some costs there. But yeah, I think it's going to be a while before it can really do the autonomous thing. I think there's some really smart people that are getting better and better with it. But I think for me, at least initially, my initial impression is it's a step too far. And I wouldn't necessarily go to that versus just using ChatGPT at the moment. I don't know whether that's been your experience.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? It especially like in the Twitter world and LinkedIn too. Everybody's, if I have to see another tweet or another LinkedIn post that starts off with ChatGTP is old news, AutoGTP is the new thing, and I'm like, come on, like, they all start the same, which is hilarious, because I'm also thinking in the back of my mind, I'm like, are all these people just using AI to create the same tweets?
Yes, they are.
Yeah, I can send you a link.
I can send you a link because they are. I know the platform. Anyway.
Yeah, so that's one kind of concern there, but yeah, it's interesting. I think it's a cool implementation of the technology. It is scary to a degree because it is connected to the internet. It is semi-autonomous in ways where it can be, you know, there's some bad use cases out there of you know, someone that they're being facetious and they're pointing this out to the general public to make kind of a stance, but they created that chaos GPT, which is basically auto GPT, but with the intent of kind of like, you know, destroying the world.
I'm not saying that.
So if you search chaos GPT, there's tons of stuff on it. And the whole point is, but it's to make kind of more of like a political statement or a point as to we should be careful about what we're doing with these technologies, because in the wrong hands, they could be used for harm. And so as far as kind of like the pause situation and that controversy, you know, I don't think it's necessarily the right thing to do to pause AI, but in kind of some of the evolution of it. But I do think we need to put heavier emphasis and put strong emphasis on like the safety and the alignment of these models and the way that we're interacting with them, because we could, you know, people don't understand exponential growth. And when you start to truly understand exponential growth, and when you think about the capabilities of today and what's capable tomorrow, it's crazy, right? Like, I mean, it's so fast. And so I think we do need to be careful. And so I think it's finding some sort of approach of kind of moving forward, but also ramping up, I don't know if it's some sort of governing body or some sort of way to regulate in without kind of hindering technology, you know, and stopping us from moving forward. I know, like on the All In podcast, I know they were talking about like an FDA, essentially kind of looking at the FDA, which is the Food Drug Administration here in the United States. I know the UK or EU has a similar thing, but taking a model like that and potentially applying it to AI could be interesting, but I don't know. I think that the speed at which governments run and the speed at which AI runs are on completely different playing fields, and I think it's going to be a difficult challenge for us to handle as humans.
Yeah. I mean, looking at things on the positive side, because of course that, you know, there's always two ways of looking at things. Is
yep,
I do often make myself smile because we are almost getting to that sort of iRobot type sci-fi movie, aren't we? You know, and I think to myself, like, you know, even if the world were to end, like, I kind of lived the sci-fi movie. Do you know what I mean? You know, we were alive in a time where basically technology effed stuff up. Do you know what I mean? So that's how I look at things positively. And that's even with the dire that's looking at the dire consequences and looking at them positively. But on the other side of things, as you guys are proving, I really hope that if there is more governance, and, you know, as people are able to use these tools in a safer way, that people can become solopreneurs, people can build their own businesses with, you know, quickly and start putting their value into the world. I really do hope, and I'm hoping to, hopefully I can talk more about this one day, is that I'm hoping that my kids, 10 months and 2.5 years of age, never have to go through the decision that says, you know, to live, I need to make X amount of money. I don't want them to have to think about getting onto the corporate ladder to sustain a way of life. My wish for them is that they can decide what they're passionate about, and they can use technology to do it and make money from it. You know, and I think without needing to know how to code, you know, without needing to have experience with all of these different things, it's going to come down to how well they can use a combination of tools, essentially. It's the same for everybody. But that's my hope anyway. And that's my optimistic side, saying that the technology is there. I quite like everybody not to be subject to the golden handcuffs anymore and be wedded to a job that they hate.
Right.
I'd like them to be able to take this technology and say, look, I'm going to follow my passions. You know, a whole wave of digital nomads, you know, from the beach.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's part of our mission too, is that, you know, we work with a lot of small businesses, and I always make the joke that founders wear a lot of hats, right? And finance is not the sexiest hat in a founder's closet. And so, you know, if we can use AI I'm not even going to sugarcoat it. It's like, I think it's goofy when especially like larger corporations say like, you know, we're going to make payroll fun. It's like payroll is never fun. But like, if we can use technology like GPT and AI to make you understand like, wow, okay, why is this important? Why, you know, how can we use finance to our advantage? How can I now play on the same level playing field as a company that has 10 times the amount of resources us, that has a fully dedicated FP&A team and a CFO and all that, and I'm just a single, you know, founder? That's the goal, is to level that playing field so that folks like that can compete. And so I'm optimistic as well. I think there's so many strong positive use cases for the use of AI to kind of better the lives and of the many and create economic opportunities for folks that maybe wouldn't have had it, you know, had they not had access to these sort of tools.
100%. Fine. So the last question I always ask is, and we've spoken about the systems that you use, so we've spoken about Slack, Trello, ChatGPT, all of that sort of stuff. The last question I always ask is, irrespective of maybe the tools that you use for business, even though it could be a business tool, is there a piece of software? It could even be a gadget. I see, is it a diffuser that you've got in the background? Could be something like that, you know. But what piece of tech or gadget could you not live without?
You know, we have already, this podcast has been a promotion for Loom. So I can't mention Loom anymore. But Loom is out there.
Yeah.
I swear I'm not affiliated. But I'll give you one that folks probably haven't heard of. It's old fashioned software that you actually have to download. So if you're a Mac user, I know, right? Like desktop software, what? It's completely free. It's made by kind of some indie developers. It's called LiceCap, LiceCap, and it's just a simple tool for Mac users to record your screen and make GIFs. And I'm constantly like, I'm going through all of our documentation for just help articles and stuff. And rather than using screenshots, I think GIFs are so much better. And so I use LiceCap to just simply record a GIF, throw it on the desktop, and then you can kind of, you know, upload it to wherever you're at. Simple little tool, completely free, indie developers, old school. But I use it a lot.
I love that. We've never had that one before.
I figured that one that wouldn't be mentioned.
Yeah. And then Googling, it does appear that there is a Windows version as well.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
On Softonic, you can get it. I don't know whether it works or not.
Yeah.
At least people can have a bit of a Google.
And I'm sure there's tons of other tools out there that do the same thing. But I don't know. I found this one and I can use it and it works. And yeah.
Perfect. No. That's great, Joe. I appreciate we've run over time a little bit, but I really enjoyed that. I think it was a really good conversation. So really appreciate you coming on. As I say, maybe in 12 months' time, when you're a massive organization, you know, and you hit with your targets, we can have a conversation. We can talk about how you did it. And it might be a conversation that says, well, I don't do anything anymore because the AI does all of it. We'll have to see. No, we really appreciate your time, Joe. It's been amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Adam, thank you so much. Really enjoyed it. Thanks so much. And yeah, have a great rest of your day.
Yeah, will do. Thanks, John. Cheers.